I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. A chance meeting with a man incarcerated in a New Jersey prison 40 years ago changed our guest's life. Jim McCluskey was studying at Princeton Theological Seminary and volunteering at Rahway State Prison, where he met Jorge de los Santos, who was serving a life sentence for murder. He told McCluskey he was innocent and convinced him to read the trial transcript, which McCluskey did, and became convinced that Santos was telling the truth, helping to free him from prison and clear his name. That was the start of a nonprofit Jim McCluskey founded, Centurion Ministries, now called Centurion, that has freed 63 men and women serving life or death sentences for crimes they did not commit. The organization takes on the tough cases, using well-honed detective skills to track down lost and new evidence, often finding shocking miscarriages of justice. Jim McCluskey is retired from Centurion, although he's still involved with some cases, and he's written a new book, When Truth is All You Have, a memoir of faith, justice, and freedom for the wrongly convicted. He joins us by Skype, and Jim McCluskey, it's been a bunch of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's a pleasure to be back and to once again talk to you, although I've listened to you many times over the years.
Well, I appreciate that. And we have a lot to talk about. Let us begin, though, with Jorge de los Santos. What was it in the transcript of his trial that made you think that this was a wrongly convicted man? I should say, at the time, and nor are you today, a lawyer. You didn't have legal training. What was it in that transcript?
Well, the transcript actually came at the end of the process of deciding whether I believed him or not. Prior to that transcript reading, which was in November of 1980 during Thanksgiving holiday from the seminary, I had spent several months on his tier speaking with him and, of course, other inmates as a student chaplain. And whenever I would come up to his cell, all he would talk about was his innocence and tell me why he's innocent. And so there was a lot of conversation, questions and answers going back and forth before I read those transcripts. Now, when I read the transcripts and I saw where he was convicted based on an eyewitness account, he was convicted of attempting to rob a used car lot one evening in Newark, New Jersey. And that went awry. And the eyewitness claimed that he saw Mr. De Los Santos fleeing the scene of the crime along with another man. Mm. Now, he identified the other man as well. And as it turned out, prior to we're going to call him Chiefy. That was his nickname.
Right, Chiefy. Yeah.
Chief. So prior to Chiefy's trial, the other man was exonerated by his public defender because he proved that the eyewitness was wrong because his client was in Oakland, California when this crime occurred. So one bad eyewitness testimony, that was number one. Number two, the only other evidence offered against Mr. De Los Santos, Chiefy, was a jailhouse, a career criminal who claimed that while in the Essex County Jail in Newark, Chiefy had confessed the crime to him. Well, at that time, Marty, I was completely unskilled, unschooled in anything having to do with the criminal justice system. And I had a difficult time understanding why would somebody testify about a supposed confession by the defendant if it weren't true. So anyway, when I came back from the holiday after reading the transcripts, again, I asked him a lot of questions, and he told me that Richard Delasante, right, who was the jailhouse confession witness, and by the way, I think it's interesting, De Los Santos, the defendant, and Delasante, the star witness, both mean of the saints.
Interesting. Coincidence, yes.
Neither was a saint, although Chiefy was certainly not a killer. Anyway, I said, he said, look, you've asked me a ton of questions. Do you believe I'm innocent? I said, well, yeah, I do believe you're innocent. Then he challenged me. Yeah. He said, well, what are you going to do about it? I said, what do you mean, what am I going to do about it? I can't do anything. I'm a former businessman. I'm a seminary student. I'm 37 at the time. I wasn't a young seminary student. I was mid-career after 12 years in the business and 3 years as a U.S. Navy officer, 1 year of which was spent in Vietnam. But I said, Chiefy, I don't know anything about investigation or law or murder or anything like that. He said, well, look, I've been praying for somebody to come along for the last 7 years to help me free that man. And I believe God has appointed you to be that man. Hmm. You are that man. What are you going to do? Go back to your seminary and pray in your nice, secure, safe little seminary? I said, well, actually, yeah, that's what I was thinking about doing. Anyway, he challenged me, and then I went back to the seminary and thought about it, prayed about it, went into scripture, and felt that God had led me to his cell to try and take a year off and work to free this man, which I did.
Which you did, and it took a couple of years. I mean, it almost sounds as if he shamed you into taking on his case, saying essentially, yeah, you're just going to go back to your nice, safe seminar and pray for me, that was not enough.
That's right. He did shame me. He made me really examine myself. Who am I? You know, in the book of James, it talks about faith is dead without works, and I came to believe that this was why God led me to his cell to help free this man, thinking nothing else other than doing what I could to move the ball forward to try and free him.
Well, it's interesting. You talk about De La Santi, the man who basically had done this jailhouse confession. You got him to talk to you and, in a sense, confess to you what he had done. How were you able to do that?
Well, Mr. De La Santi was a professional, to use the trade term, snitch, jailhouse snitch. He had, as it turned out, we were able to prove this beyond a doubt with a lot of documentation as well as himself. He had testified in a number of cases even prior to Chiefy's case. And after Chiefy's case, he had offered a jailhouse confession, a false jailhouse confession, against his first cousin, Danny De La Santi.
Wow.
So one of the first things I did in my investigation was go to Danny himself. He was in Trenton prison doing life. And then to his mother. His mother was Richard's aunt, De La Santi's aunt, was in constant contact with him. She had even taken his wife and their children in, hoping that somehow she could convince Richard to do the right thing and come forward and admit that he lied against her son, Danny De La Santi. So anyway, it took a year. I wrote him several letters. Dottie, Danny's mother, vouched for me and asked Richard to please talk with Mr. McCluskey. If he's successful with Chiefy, they'll be successful with Danny. Anyway, a year later, in February of 82, I'm in my room, and at 9 o'clock one night, I get a phone call, and it's this Richard De La Santi. He says, look, he didn't waste any time. He said, look, I know who you are, what you're doing. Dottie has vouched for you. I'm ready to talk to you. When can you come up? At that point, he was in the Jersey City County, the Hoboken County Jail in Jersey City. So the next day, I was up there. We spent 2 full days together. And basically, yeah, he confessed to me. He told me that he had lied against Danny and against Chiefy. And he did it because the Newark drug world, he was a drug addict. The Newark drug world and those in prison knew that he was a snitch. And the prosecutor's office in Essex County assured him that he would never go to jail if he continued to provide this jailhouse confession kind of testimony in a number of cases, including Chiefy's and Danny. So he saved himself many, many years, even decades in prison by offering this false testimony. However, after 10 years of living this life on the streets, and at the whims and mercy of the Essex County Prosecutor's Office, he had enough. He was tired. He was exhausted. He decided to do what he could to make things right and change his life.
I do want to pick up on all the criminal justice issues this case raises, but let me ask you, you got Jorge De Los Santos out of prison, essentially exonerated, showing that he did not commit the crime of which he was convicted. What happened to him?
Well, it was a sad case. Chiefy was 28 years old when he was falsely convicted of this crime. He ended up doing 7 years until we freed him in the summer of 1983. But he was a drug addict prior to his incarceration for this murder. And when he got out, he had a very difficult time adjusting to the free world. Yeah. He felt insecure, low self-esteem. And even though he was married to a lovely woman, Elena was her name, who always looked after him during his drug addiction days. And while he was incarcerated, she stood by him. Nevertheless, he descended back into the world of drug addiction, and went ahead and committed an armed robbery of another drug person in Newark, and was given a 10-year sentence. So in about 1960, I'm sorry, 1985 or so, he was sent back to New Jersey State prisons. By that time, he was so ashamed of what he had done, I could not, he would not talk to me. He couldn't face me. I wasn't going to be angry at him, but I certainly was certainly disappointed. Anyway, when he was finally freed from that jail sentence in the early 90s or 93, he went up to New York and was murdered, and his body was found on a vacant lot in a drug deal that apparently went awry.
I mean, what a tragic story. But for you, Jim McCluskey, was it still worth what you did to get him out of prison and essentially get him exonerated of murder? As you said, he was no saint, but you didn't think he was a murderer.
Well, absolutely. And to this day, I'm thankful that I encountered him and worked for him and freed him. I can honestly say that a man from Puerto Rico, a drug addict from Newark, saved my life as well as me trying to save his life. And were it not for him, regardless of what happened to him after we freed and exonerated him, were it not for him, I would have been lost in the world with no sense of purpose or mission. And there would not be a Centurion Ministries, or Centurion, as you pointed out, it's called today. And an argument can be made that 62 other men and women would not be freed were it not for Mr. De Los Santos, that drug heroin addict from Newark, New Jersey.
There's a scene, we're almost up in a break here, Jim, but there's a scene where Mr. De Los Santos is reunited with the woman that he loves and who loves him. And you go back to your apartment kind of feeling, I mean, here was this great success, but you were feeling lonely and alone.
Yes, I was when we freed him in the summer of '83. I was 41 years old, single. I had returned to the seminary to get my degree. In fact, had received my degree at that same time, but I was living as I had been for the last 3 years in a rent-free room in a home owned and occupied in Princeton by a delightful octogenarian, Mrs. Yateman. But when I returned that night from delivering Chiefy to his long-awaited wife, Elena, he had her. He had love in his life. I had no one. I went back to my room and I was alone. I had no relationships at that time. And I have to say, I was feeling very lonely. And even in the midst of that joy of freeing him, it was a bittersweet moment. And I envy Chiefy for being with a woman who stood by him and loved him.
Well, Jim, we have to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Jim McCluskey, the founder of Centurion Ministries, now called Centurion. He's got a new book, When Truth Is All You Have. And we have Richard Miles, who'll be joining us after this short break, a man exonerated by Centurion. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking with Jim McCluskey about the 40 years he's been working to free the wrongly convicted from prison. He founded Centurion Ministries, now called Centurion, to reinvestigate suspicious cases, exonerating 63 men and women. He's got a new memoir titled When Truth Is All You Have. You can join us, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. One of those men that was exonerated by Centurion is Richard Miles. He was wrongly convicted of murder in 1995 and served 15 years of his 60-year sentence. He always claimed his innocence, was released with the help of Centurion. He founded a nonprofit in Texas called Miles of Freedom to help individuals transition and stay out of prison. Richard Miles, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, and I'm excited to be a part of this interview.
Well, me too, and I know that you know Jim McCluskey. He writes about you at the near the end of your book, but I want to just put a couple of questions to you, Richard Miles, before we get Jim back in on the conversation. And reading about your case and knowing that you were innocent, I was trying to put myself into your shoes, what it would be like to be sentenced to 60 years in prison for a crime I did not commit. And I just want to know how you coped with that in those early days of being in prison?
Yes, ma'am. So a great question. And the first thing that I can say is my family support system. I was blessed to have a very solid family connection with my mom, my dad, and my siblings. Even beyond that, growing up, I grew up in a very spiritually grounded household, which was very important the full time of my incarceration. And I think the final thing is I met so many men that was wrongfully incarcerated on the unit that I was on in Texas. And a lot of these men helped me navigate through the system and file my writ of habeas corpus and so forth. So it was a combination of elements that really secured me during my journey.
Richard, let me read something that Jim writes in his book about people like yourself who've been wrongly convicted. He writes, their closest friend in prison, the ally that gives them the strength to endure even in the depths of their despair, is their absolute knowledge of the truth of their innocence. It is the truth, the honest, unwavering bedrock of truth upon which they stand day after cruel, heartbreaking day. Knowing you were innocent, did you, as Jim writes in this book, feel some strength of that?
Yes, ma'am, most definitely. There's a scripture passage that speaks about the peace that surpasses all understanding. And the reality is it doesn't matter the circumstance. When a person is innocent, there is a calmness and a peace in that. And I think every innocent person walks through life with that calm peace. And it tends to cover or protect us from a lot of harm that would not impact other
sure.
people.
You were freed on October 2009 after serving 15 years. You were exonerated on February 2012, found factually innocent. What did that mean to you?
It was a total game changer. My case is the first non-DNA, no confession case in Dallas, Texas. I was released in 2009. So to me,
oops. Ooh, we seem to have lost our guest. We're going to call him back. Jim McCluskey, let me get you back in on the conversation here. We were listening to Richard Miles. I think we got disconnected somehow, so we will reconnect with him. It's such an important case, and his the charges against him just seem to be built on sand. Can you just speak to how Centurion got involved?
Yes, let me tell you two things that happened that caused his wrongful conviction. One by the police, one by the trial prosecutor. Three months before his trial, he's in jail awaiting trial. The homicide detectives got a call from a woman who told them, "You have the wrong man for this shooting at the Texaco station last May. The real killer is," and she named him Keith Richards, who was a former boyfriend of hers, and he told me that he shot the two men at the Texaco station with a 9mm gun, and you have the wrong man in prison. Uh-huh. Now, that the weapon was never told, was never revealed or released by the police. So this is something only the police and the killer do. All right. So what did they do with that information? Well, they already had what they thought was their case against Richard wrapped up through a one eyewitness testimony. And so they buried that. They didn't reinvestigate it. They did nothing with it. They didn't even tell the prosecutors about that possible lead onto the real killer. That's number one. Number two, at the trial, he was convicted based on a sole eyewitness account, which, by the way, was rebutted or contradicted by six other eyewitnesses in terms of skin color and the clothing the killer was wearing. Anyway, the lone eyewitness comes in and tells the trial prosecutor, "Listen, I'm sorry, I can't make an ID here. I can't remember who was the shooter and what he looked like." The trial prosecutor said to him, "Before you get on when you get on the stand, look at the defense table. The person who is not speaking, That's the lawyer is speaking. The person next to him is the defendant. He's the man you are to identify.
Wow.
And he went ahead and made that false identification. 15 years later, he admitted to the prosecutor, Conviction Integrity Unit of Dallas County Prosecutor's Office, that he lied. Why he lied? Because he was afraid of that trial prosecutor.
Wow. We've got Richard Miles back with us. Richard, I was just talking with Jim McCluskey about your case. And when we got disconnected, I was asking you about when you were finally exonerated and found factually innocent, what that meant to you.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. And so, as I was saying, I had two releases. My physical release was in 2009, not fully exonerated. And my mental release was in 2012. And I feel like that empowered me to really begin to make some changes within the system and add value in my life, value that had been taken out for over 17 years at that point.
Were you ever, are you bitter, angry about what happened to you?
I mean, I've had time to process anger. I had time to process bitterness. At the end of the day, I can't lay in those emotions because they are non-productive, and they would end up killing me more than it would hurt the people that I'm angry at. And so my anger, I feel like it's targeted towards growing an organization and helping people impacted by incarceration.
And that organization is Miles of Freedom. Jim McCluskey, you talk about anger, and you've dealt with a lot of people who've been wrongly convicted, that anger is another prison. And yet at the same time, one can understand the kind of rage of being falsely convicted, especially when there's so much miscarriage of justice at stake.
Well, that's true, Marty. And let me say something about that. Most, not all, but a great majority of our exonerees, people we have freed after, in most cases, decades in prison for something they didn't do, a consistent theme runs through their descriptions of their experience, and that is this. For the first 10 years or so of their incarceration, they are angry, they're full of hatred, they think all kinds of bad things about the people who put them there. But then once they realize, as Richard has done and just expressed, this anger and this hatred is like a cancer eating them up, eating their soul up, eating their mind up. And they begin to realize, hey, listen, this is just killing me. It's not hurting anybody else. I need to start to let that go. So they start to let it go. And there's also a measure of forgiveness as well. And then when that starts to take place, their attitude in prison changes. They have different relationships with the guards. It's much more positive. The guards notice a change in them, although they're not sure why, what accounts for that change. Then they start relating to people from the outside world, and one thing leads to another, and they start attracting people who can help them from the outside world, such as ourselves. And by the time they get out, usually 20, 25, sometimes many years longer, by the time they get out, and they also were young when they went in, and they also start to mature as human beings as well as a result of all this suffering. So once they get out, then they still have PTSD. There's no question about that. A lot do not recognize that still lurks with plagues them within them. But nevertheless, they're able to, after it takes a couple of years to get their feet on the ground, to feel comfortable in the world of people. Well, one more thing. Most of them come out really liking and loving people. It's amazing how that transformation takes place within those many years of false incarceration.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jim McCluskey. He founded Centurion Ministries almost 40 years ago, and he's written a memoir. It's called When Truth Is All You Have, a memoir of faith, justice, and freedom for the wrongly convicted. Also with us is Richard Miles. He was wrongly convicted. He served 15 years of a 60-year sentence for a crime he did not commit, a murder. You can join us, Radio Times at whyy.org. You can tweet us at whyy Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Richard Miles, let me go back to you and just picking up on what Jim McCluskey was just talking about reentry, about coming back into the world. You were a young man. I think you were, 20 years old when you were 19. So you were in your 30s when you were released from prison. What was that reentry like for you? I mean, just to get back into the world again.
Well, I mean, it was totally crazy. I mean, keeping in mind that when a person is incarcerated, particularly in Texas, you are physically dislocated. I mean, I was not even in Dallas. So a lot of the burst of Dallas, I knew nothing about it. I oftentimes say I recognized my family but didn't know them. My dad passed 6 months before I got out. When I went to prison, I had just purchased a beeper. When I got out, it was iPhones everywhere. So technology, relationships, when you're in prison, you can't have relationships with really women because it's not that type of environment. And so the communication between genders is a problem. Any plans that you may have are deterred by, you know, changes in the community. I was blessed to have my mom still alive. And so I had a place to lay my head, which is the biggest factor coming out of prison. It's hard. It's hard because it's not a lot of resources pre-release that really helps the person coming out of prison to be successful and move past just living and trying to thrive and survive.
And we should say that you're married, you have a daughter. I mean, it seems as if, and you started this organization to help others who have been, their parolees, right? Help them and also help the community essentially stay out of prison.
Yes, ma'am. So Miles of Freedom was started after I was exonerated. You know, we lobbied in Texas, and so the compensation allotted for a person that's wrongfully incarcerated, we took that to start Miles of Freedom. We have reentry programs that assist the person directly with services. We feel that not only the person is incarcerated, but the family is incarcerated. So what type of services can we provide for them? And being a visible presence in the community, just giving hope beyond incarceration is really what Miles of Freedom is here to do and be.
Jim, you write about Miles's mother. You interview her. She's part of this story about the impact of having a child in this case wrongly convicted of a crime and what it's like for that family, in this case, Miles's mother, to endure, in a sense, a version of what he had to endure.
Absolutely. And I've, obviously, Richard could speak to that as well. But Thelma Lloyd, his mother, this obviously not only affects the wrongly convicted, but his family or her family and loved ones and people close to him, his whole world. It reverberates out like a stone thrown into water, just ripples and ripples out. But Thelma, she and her husband, before he died, before Richard was freed, they had a church in South Dallas. They were pastors, and people started leaving their church because they felt that, your son's a murderer. What kind of parents are you? And now you're our pastor. So they lost some parishioners. They lost some close family members who felt the same thing. They were condemned by people very close to them and left to be amongst themselves. So Thelma was very much alone in the world as she supported her son. And by visiting him at least once a month and accepting his phone calls, which are not inexpensive. And she was his lifeline. But she also suffered in her own world on the outside, plus having a broken heart that her son was in prison for something he didn't do.
Miles, you want to talk about your mother?
Most definitely. My mom, she has been the backbone going in prison. As Jim said, every month my dad would make sure my mom would come see me. And even her searching for a young lady by the name of Miss Joyce Ann Brown, who was another person that Centurion exonerated, These two women really worked together, man, to push my case forward and to get Centurion very interested in my case. And when I got out, you know, my dad had just died, and I think God had opened the door so I could then support my mom, who had been married to Bishop William L. Lloyd for, I believe, about 30 years at that time.
Wow.
And so we all suffered, yes.
I do want to talk to Jim McCluskey about his faith, but let me talk to you, Richard Miles, about your faith. How important was it for you when you were in prison wrongly convicted?
Oh, my faith, you know, at the end of the day, I feel like we as a society, we wear faith on our shoulders, but it has not been tested, tried, and proved. When I went to prison for something that I did not do, it was at that point in time that everything that I was taught growing up in church, it had to be manifested. And the manifestation of that was through the story of Joseph. I remember when I first got incarcerated, I'm looking at the Bible. I'm like, hey, God, you know, you say you're true. I'm in a Joseph situation, and I need you to manifest yourself. Mm-hmm. And I held on to that faith, and to the point of miles of freedom, Joseph was released not only to help his family, but to help a community and a nation. So my faith has been manifested, but I had to try it. It had to be tried.
It had to be tried. Was that hard for you?
It was. At the age of 30, 11 years in, I gave up. I hadn't heard from anybody. You know, I had wrote letters. I had filed writs of habeas corpus. And my reality was 60 years in prison, beyond me being innocent, beyond me being let down by the system. And so, yes, I gave up. And ironically, 2 years after that is when Centurion came into my life and really started changing the game.
Well, Richard Miles, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm glad that Century Ministries found you and you found them and that you got exonerated and certainly the work that you're doing, Miles of Freedom. Richard Miles, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Hey, Richard, I love you too, Jim.
Yeah.
And we're going to carry on with Jim McCluskey after this very short break. He founded Centurion Ministries almost 40 years ago, and he's got a new book, a memoir, When Truth Is All You Have. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Jim McCluskey for the rest of the hour. He founded Centurion Ministries, now called Centurion, in 1983 after getting an innocent man freed from a New Jersey prison. The mission of the nonprofit, which is located in Princeton, New Jersey, is to exonerate the wrongly convicted who've been sentenced to either life in prison or death. The organization has helped to free more than 60 people, one of whom we just talked to, often the toughest cases that do not involve DNA, uncovering shocking abuses in the criminal justice system. Jim is going to carry on our conversation, talking about his work, his life, his faith, his new memoir, When the Truth Is All You Have. Jim, a couple of comments from some of our listeners. Kyle asks, are there any estimates for how many people in jail are actually innocent or not guilty of the charges or were convicted with questionable evidence? Do we know the answer to that question?
Yes. The short answer to that is we do not know. Anybody who really says they can offer what they consider to be a reasonable or fairly accurate estimate is just misplaced testimony. However, let me say this. First of all, Centurion only takes on cases where we believe somebody is innocent and convicted of murder or sexual assault state county. In other words, state inmates, not federal inmates.
Right, correct.
There are, as of at least 2016, and probably not too much different than that, there are about 340,000 state inmates across the country who are doing life for murder and or sexual assault. Now, I don't know how many of those are innocent. They're the only kinds of cases we take on. But it wouldn't surprise me if among those 340,000 convicted people, 10% or tens of thousands might very well be innocent. Now, I can't prove that, and I'm not saying I can, But the listener asked me that question, and that would be my basic answer. It's an estimate, and that's all it is.
I read that the National Registry of Exonerations, that since 1989, 2,500 people have been exonerated, 123 on death rows. Does that square with your understanding?
Yes, that does. I thought the number of exonerees off of death row was up to 100, almost 170.
Okay.
But that's still a lot. I mean, when you think about it, Marty, since the death penalty, capital punishment was reinstated by the Supreme Court back in the mid-70s, some 1,500 men and a couple women have been executed. During that same period of time, about 170 people were exonerated, freed, declared innocent, off of death row. So for every 10 executed, one has been exonerated, basically. That's pretty shoddy work on the part of our criminal justice system. And I think should give anybody pause as to whether or not they have confidence in the efficacy and accuracy of our criminal justice system, and especially as it applies to death row cases. We've taken on a number of death row cases during our history as well.
Here's an email from Stu. What penalties do corrupt prosecutors pay?
Good question. And again, the answer to that is hardly any. First of all, if a prosecutor breaks the law, suborns perjury, falsifies evidence during a trial, that prosecutor is immune from civil suits. However, that prosecutor can be charged with breaking those laws. However, I'm only aware of two or three prosecutors who have suffered the consequence of falsely presenting false evidence at trial, knowingly presenting false evidence at trial. And when they have been caught and prosecuted, they only do 1 or 2 days in jail, maybe disbarred, but in comparison to those who they wrongly prosecuted, doing decades in prison. Well, so it's very unfair. There should be far more accountability. And those prosecutors who misconduct themselves criminally before and during a trial should be really prosecuted and held to account.
I have a couple of questions about your faith. One, faith in our criminal justice system, but also your religious faith. But based on the stories in your book of people like Richard Miles who've been wrongly convicted, there are incidents of the manipulation of evidence, of coercion of witnesses, of people lying on the stand, of the use of informants, withholding information, racism, cover-ups, witness intimidation, tunnel vision, as you describe it, dubious forensic information. Do you have faith in our criminal justice system?
Oh, boy.
Based on that list there. Obviously, you're talking about people where the system failed them. But no, go ahead.
Let me say this, that I think the people should be aware, especially if you're sitting on a jury, not to take as gospel the word of a witness for the prosecution or a police officer testifying on behalf of the prosecution. I held that view prior to getting involved in this work. I thought that our American criminal justice system was basically infallible. And if maybe an innocent person was wrongly convicted, that was certainly an aberration and an isolated incident. Now, 40 years down the road, I have a far different view. I don't think it's uncommon for a person to be falsely convicted. For all the reasons that you just listed, including police and prosecutorial misconduct, basically, you know, some changes obviously need to be made in our criminal justice system. There has to be more transparency. There has to be more accountability. You know, it's so difficult to free an innocent person because the system has set up procedural and time bars that if you develop new evidence of an innocent person, you must develop and present that within a year of the last denial of his appeal. Well, this takes years and years to develop new evidence, and it comes out in bits and pieces over time. The U.S. Supreme Court has disallowed the U.S. Supreme Court will not consider a case of actual innocence unless it has a constitutional flaw attached to the conviction. In other words, we call it a freestanding claim of actual innocence. So the system has to allow. This is a change that needs to be made. Several states, including Texas, by the way, have already instituted this. Anytime you develop new evidence of innocence, no matter how long it takes, when you develop that and put your case of innocence together, you can come back to our court and we will review that new evidence, whether it's 1 year, 5 years, 20 years later, you can do that. The U.S. Supreme Court will not allow you to do that in their federal court system, which is, to me, just a terrible ruling. But I still have faith that, you know, most of the time, in a trial, the defendant did what he or she was convicted of doing. But there are so many thousands and thousands of cases where that is not true for a variety of circumstances that come together to falsely incarcerate that person.
Well, let me ask you about your religious faith, and you did study at Princeton Theological Seminary, and you write a lot in this book about things that you described as shameful things that you had done in your life, and sort of looking for some purpose in your life. But you do write at the end of your book, my faith fluctuates. It's less certain. I still believe that Christ led me to this, but there have been stretches of time when I have felt the absence of God and when I questioned God's very existence. So how do you wrestle with your faith today?
Well, you know, that's true, what you just read that I wrote, and it still stands today. But I'm in good company with Mother Teresa, of all people. During her decades of working in the cities of India and other places around the world, she wrote private letters to her spiritual advisor. And I relate to what she wrote because she felt, where is God? Does God really exist? I feel a darkness. I've lost connection with God. Is God real? And I still struggle with that. Although I do go back and forth. And right now where I am, I connect to God and to Christ by reading Scripture, and that to me is basically, although it's not infallible, that's where I get my sustenance and my renewal of my faith by going back into the Scriptures and doing my best to live out those dictates and principles laid out by God and the Lord.
Is there a certain passage that is very meaningful to you? And then we'll take Jose, who's joining us by telephone. But go ahead, Jim McCoskey.
The passage, there's a number of passages, but in my work, I lean on the prophetic words of Isaiah, who said, where is justice? Justice is turned back. There is no justice. Truth has fallen from the public squares. They come to law dishonestly. They weave their webs like the spider. But the Lord looked upon it and wondered that there was no one to intervene. Well, you know, I along with a lot of other people across this country who are doing good work, I felt that God has called me to intervene on behalf of the wrongly convicted. My sense of call to do this work is just as strong as it was 40 years ago. But in the interim, during these years of seeing this, you know, why, if there is a just and loving God, why does he or she allow all this suffering, this unjust suffering? And the one passage that sheds some light on it, but I don't find particularly 100% satisfactory, when Jesus was speaking on the Mount, the Beatitudes, he said that it rains on the just and the unjust, and the sun shines on the good and the evil. Now I looked at that and I said, "Is that it, Lord? No matter who we are, or how we behave here on earth, or what we do, good or bad, we're all going to either have good times and bad times." So then when I read that, after one of our clients was sent back to death row down in Texas, Kerry Max Cook, I said, "Well, I guess that's just the way it is. And I don't know if I can depend on the Lord to help us free these people. We just got to get out there and do it, because, hey, sometimes the truth will not emerge and the truth doesn't set you free. But you got to do your best to find that truth and present it."
Jim, let me get Jose to join our conversation. And Jose, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, very inspirational. My question to you is the idea of the prosecutor's role in the judiciary and their role in prosecuting people, and the dialogue that is taking place out on the street today around the country regarding the legal system and its prosecutorial and its law enforcement. What are your thoughts on that particular relationship, and do you think that there should be reforms that are taking place within the prosecutor's offices to prevent or hold them more accountable?
Jose, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jim, we're almost out of time here, but obviously referencing the protests, the killings, the shootings that we have observed over the summer, and the kind of protest of our criminal justice system. We're almost out of time, but go ahead.
Well,
sorry about that.
Well, that's okay. But, you know, I can't answer all his good questions there. But in my view, Black lives really matter. And of course, all lives matter. But Black lives have not mattered for pretty much the history of this country. And now, finally, because of these unbelievably fatal, unjustified police shootings, people are starting to realize, hey, wait a minute here. There's racial bias in our police departments and among law enforcement that maybe we weren't aware of. I mean, when you think about this, Marty, I don't know, since 2014, some 20 fatal killings have taken place of Black citizens. Why is it that in every place, in every instance of a fatal shooting where there's no real provocation, the victim was Black and the police officer was white? And this occurred in, you know, you go New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Atlanta, Georgia, you know, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Chicago, Tucson, St. Louis. You go all across the country. And now this most recent one in Wisconsin, something's wrong, folks. And unfortunately, African Americans suffer not only these terrible travesties of loss of life by white police officers, but they suffer daily indignities that we white people have no idea exist every day. So it's Black lives do matter. Although they haven't mattered in 400 years of our history.
Jim McCluskey, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times once again. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Yep.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the book is called When Truth is All You Have, A Memoir of Faith, Justice, and Freedom for the Wrongly Convicted. And he founded Centurion Ministries almost 40 years ago, now called Centurion, and it works to free the wrongly convicted. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.